Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. They will need thy blessings, for the enemy is strong.
With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done.
Some D-Day words from President Franklin Roosevelt, as read aloud by President Trump at the 75th anniversary commemoration, and as spoken then by FDR himself. With me now, Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations think tank. He's been a key foreign policy advisor to both presidents named George Bush and to Colin Powell when Powell was Secretary of State. His books on U.S. foreign policy range from The Reluctant Sheriff, published in 1997, to his latest, published in 2017, A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. Richard, nice of you to give us some time on this solemn and historic day. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me back, Brian.
You weren't alive for D-Day. I wasn't alive for D-Day. These are such different times. What is looking back on this making you think about?
Well, quite a lot. Those pictures this morning were haunting, I thought. It's also probably the last time that that generation will be alive to participate. Well, you know, the things that come to mind are the sense of public service, in the ultimate sense, and then also the America's involvement in Europe, the closeness of the allies. It really was one of those turning points in history. You know, one of the, I think, most interesting things is Eisenhower also prepared a second statement. Had things gone badly, had D-Day essentially failed. And it's haunting to hear, because then you would then have to play out how history might have then evolved much differently and much worse.
Listeners, I want to invite anyone to call in about anything relating to D-Day. And first, I'd like to invite any of our oldest listeners who might remember D-Day. I guess you'd have to be at least 93 or so to have fought in it or been in the military at all at that moment. God bless you if you're out there. We welcome your calls with your feelings and memories at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. But also anyone else who is just old enough to remember D-Day, maybe as a child. I'm sure some of you in your 80s have memories of hearing about it. So we invite you to call in and tell everyone else what you remember from that day or the end of the war generally. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And even not just memories of the moment, but maybe how World War II shaped your thinking about war, shaped your thinking about the world, about the U.S. place in the world, shaped your view of the white rising tide today of what we might call white Christian ethno-nationalism, as we continue with Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Richard, I've been getting my mind around some of these staggering numbers, which maybe we vaguely know, but they are so staggering when we focus on them. According to history.com, 4,414 Americans were killed on D-Day, more than 4,400 in one day. And it says they took 200,000 German prisoners of war. There were also so many French and British and Canadian and Russian deaths there. It's staggering in today's terms. And just by point of comparison, the number of American D-Day deaths is almost the exact same number as the official Defense Department number of all American deaths in the Iraq War, which is 4,410. It was 4,414 on D-Day, and twice as many on D-Day alone as in the entire Afghanistan War, which now is our longest war, but with around 2,200 American deaths, and this is just American deaths. But still, it's a little perspective on the magnitude of that loss at that time, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It gives you a sense of the scale of World War II. You know, the phrase that was used and is used in the history books is total war. Both World War I and World War II had a degree of national mobilization and national participation, whether soldiers sent overseas or on the home front. There was very little that was not one way or another directly or indirectly linked to the war effort. And I just contrast that, Brian, with contemporary wars where we don't have a draft. The number of troops in theater, even say 100,000 at times in Iraq or Afghanistan, the number of deaths, and as you suggest, the statistics are fundamentally different. And they were not these were not total wars in the sense that most Americans went about their lives in recent wars, essentially not particularly mindful of what was going on, quote unquote, over there. And again, the contrast in particular with World War II couldn't be more stark.
And just to continue on stats, one more step, according to some stats I've been reading on various sites in the last day, more than 3% of the entire world population was killed in World War II, including about 400,000 Americans, 400,000, 5 million Germans, and 25 million Russians. And the Soviet Union, of course, was on our side in that war. Unbelievable for people who have never gotten their minds around all of this about the deadliest war in world history.
Absolutely. And a lot of the deaths were civilians on the European side. A lot of the battlefields involved, you know, towns and even built-up areas. And you mentioned the Soviet figure of literally between 20 and 25 million. It explains in part this sense of now Russian resentment. There's, even though that generation is mostly gone, there's a sense that Russia has never gotten its due for the sacrifices it made during the war. And as you recall, even some of the roots of the Cold War go back to World War II, where Stalin never felt comfortable in ways with FDR and Churchill, the delays over the Second Front, what we're talking about today, D-Day. The Soviets wanted that to occur much earlier to relieve pressure. They felt they were bearing the brunt of fighting Germany, of fighting Nazism. And some of that lingered over into the Cold War. There was always suspicions that the West was thinking about the post-World War II era, even during World War II, and vice versa. We had some of the same suspicions about what the Soviets were doing in Eastern Europe.
And just to finish the thought before we go to some calls and some other things, I see in the news today and this week that despite Russia's own contribution to D-Day and the just unthinkable losses in the Allied effort overall, Russia is trying to downplay this anniversary that we're all making such a big thing of in the United States, and they are in Britain and France, saying D-Day didn't win World War II, and the West is still trying to erase Russia from this history. Have you seen any of this Russia commentary?
I haven't, but it's so of a piece where, again, it feels that it has never gotten its due. There's tremendous resentment over just what it is you say. I thought one of the best things of the last 24, 48 hours was the presence of the German chancellor at these ceremonies. And it sends a powerful message of reconciliation. And that's, it's really been a, in this, the last 74 years have been a remarkable story of Germany's reintegration into Europe and the like. And Russia never quite reintegrated, even though it was an ally. What's so interesting is first during the Cold War and subsequently, it's always been somewhat aloof from quote unquote the West, from Western institutions. And even now there's a sense of resentment that Putin clearly harbors about how Russia has been treated, and it not just affects, but in some ways it infects the relationship still between, on one hand, the United States, and on the other hand, Russia.
Linda in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Linda.
Hi. This brings back vivid family memories. I was a baby on D-Day, but I vividly remember as I grew up my mother describing the moment when she heard the broadcast on the radio and ran rushing down the corridor of my father saying, "Mac, it's begun. And thinking about those moments of fear, of joy, and what they lived through. And it's a very, very vivid memory for me. I also would like to mention my uncle, who at that time had been part of the construction of the Mulberry Harbours, which is another very important part of what made D-Day possible and successful.
Linda, thank you so much. Florette in Flatbush, you're on WNYC. Hi, Florette.
Good morning, Brian, and thank you for taking my call. Just a minute, I just want to take you off the speaker.
Sure. As Florette picks up her handset.
Every time I touch a button on this phone, I'm afraid I'm going to cut somebody off. Brian,
sounds so much better.
I sent you an email.
Okay.
Are you there?
I did not see the email. I apologize.
Okay, because I was afraid I wouldn't get through. Accessorize picking me up at 12 o'clock. My father was an air traffic controller with the Tuskegee Airmen in World War II.
Uh-huh.
And he made a photo album of the whole story from when he was training down in to the Tuskegee Flying School, all the way to the end. The thing was that I found his, the logbook, the air traffic controller logbook,
uh-huh.
And also his World War II diary. And on the page, June 6, 1944, he mentions a little bit about the invasion. I don't think they knew too much about it because everything was kept very secret, but I show it in the movie that I made, and I read a little bit of some of his pages about some of his fellow pilots who were killed or whose planes were mm-hmm. crashed.
Do you have that in front of you?
My point is, Brian, that the name of my book is My Mother Was an Air Raid Warden. That's what the movie is based on, the video is based on. But the thing is that, I'm 85 years old now. I'm the matriarch in the family. Everybody's gone. And I'm looking at our country today, the way it's so divided, and it just makes me feel so bad that all of these people of that generation, I write about the home front and how all the sacrifices we made and everything to keep America great, to be the peacemaker of the world. And yet here we are in all this division it's very bad right now. But, I prayed my way through those war years, and my dad came home safely, thank God. But, Brian, I was in the parochial school of State New York, mm-hmm. up in Kingston. We were the first children of color to go to that school. We were the only children who had a parent, a family member in the war, and yet the principal was a racist. So she hated us. But, we survived all of that. And, I just want to thank you for taking the call, and I just wanted to share with any other people who are family members of those soldiers, those military men,
mm-hmm.
who really did what they believed in. At that time, those men fought, and the WAYS, the women, the WAYS and the WACs and the SPARs, the women in the military service. And my mother was an air raid warden. We had the civil defense workers, volunteers. And we all believed in, just helping the country bring an end to the war.
Florette.
We saved our, we gave our toys for scrap defense.
Floret, thank you so much for your call, and thanks for your parents' service, your father as a Tuskegee Airman and your mother as an air raid warden. Thank you so much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll continue with this in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we commemorate the 75th anniversary of D-Day with some of your calls, with some of your memories, either memories as children or memories if you were old enough as members of the military at that time, along with Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations think tank. He's also been a key foreign policy advisor to both Presidents Bush, to Colin Powell, and Powell as Secretary of State, and more, and author of books on U.S. foreign policy ranging from The Reluctant Sheriff, published in 1997, to his latest, published in 2017, A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. Richard, I was thinking, listening to Floret, the caller before the break, talking about how sad she is that the world is so divided now compared to back then. You know, we played that clip at the beginning of Roosevelt's words that Trump recited over there, but also some Roosevelt language that maybe Trump would not want to repeat about the Germans' white racial arrogances. He used that phrase, racial arrogances. Obviously, Trump is not Hitler or Mussolini. There's no Holocaust. We're not invading, you know, anything like the Russians. But for you, how much would you say it's a liberal overreach versus how much of a genuine concern to see the rising tide of power in the U.S. and Britain, as well as some other places in Europe right now, to be trending toward, let's say, the other side from World War II?
Look, I worry about the populism we're seeing, the attacks on government and authority, and the alienation that people feel. And I do worry about nationalism. You know, there's a point at which patriotism, which is healthy and wonderful, spills over and crosses a line of nationalism, which invokes then hatreds towards minorities with prejudice and tolerance and the like, and hatred at times towards foreigners. So I worry that we're seeing elements of that in a lot of democratic societies in our own and throughout Europe. And it's one of the reminders, Brian, that history hasn't ended, and that the last 75 years have been in some ways a remarkable respite from a lot of history. But in the same breath, that in the last 75 years were represented something of a departure. And what I think we're seeing now is some of the warning signs that we shouldn't take it for granted, that some of the thinking and movements that have shaped Western societies in the run-up to World War II and the like, that those things have the potential to return. And I take that as a warning. And also one other thing, if I may, sorry to go on so long, just 30 more seconds, given what your caller said. You know, watching things today, listening to your callers, to me it makes a powerful case that we in this country have got to do a better job of studying our own history. I wonder how many Americans coming of age understand the significance of D-Day, understand the backdrop in terms of World War II and what we were fighting for and why the fact that we won was so substantial. And this to me is a real message that in our high schools and in our colleges and the rest, that we've got to do a far more systematic job of exposing our young people to this narrative of the past.
Let's take another memory from Pat in Leonia. You're on WNYC. Hi, Pat.
Brian. I'm a little bit on the young side, but my husband was a great deal older than me, and he was in D-Day plus 2.5, which was 2.5 days after D-Day. He didn't know where he was going. It's all coming back to me, what he had said. And the way he used to say was, nobody told me they were going to be shooting at me. He kind of, you know, just relived it and was, you know, was grateful that he survived it.
And maybe that's what I want to share. He wound up with almost 200 days doing signal intelligence behind enemy lines. We're behind, so he was a non-combatant, but he used to say that didn't mean they weren't going to be shooting at me.
Mm.
And I guess that's what I want to share with you. Thank you for even bringing it up.
And thank you for sharing that, Pat. Robin in Westwood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robin.
Hey, Brian, how are you? It's a real quick story, but it's maybe a good coda to this entire thing. I grew up in a little town called Homestead, Pennsylvania, outside of Pittsburgh. So did my father. And he was one of the infantrymen in the first round of landing craft that landed on Omaha Beach. And as he was making his way through the sand that, you know, graphically depicted, for example, in Saving Private Ryan, he drops his wallet, unknown to him. And goes on, you know, they take the beach. The next day, the salvage team comes in, and they pick up the guns and put them here, and the helmets put them over there. And a man comes and sees that wallet sticking in the sand, and instead of putting it in a pile, he sticks it in his jacket. And fast forward a couple years later, that man goes home to his hometown, and he opens up a bar next to a mill gate. And it's a very popular bar for mill workers. And he's going through his personal effects, and he sees his wallet, and he realizes, oh, my God, this poor man's family lived three blocks away from him. So they lived in the same town, didn't know each other. He goes down to give the wallet back to what he assumed was a grieving family, and my grandfather comes to the door. And then my father comes to the door, and he goes, well, hey, Joe, well, what are you doing here? And Joe says, you. And he goes, well, what do you mean? He goes, I've got your wallet. He goes, well, what do you mean you've got my wallet? Well, I found it on the beach. What beach? Well, I found it on Normandy Beach. So they live three blocks away from each other. They didn't know each other because my dad used to come in there and drink a beer after work. And I believe, as the story goes, that Joe always bought my dad his first beer every time he came in there after that.
Robin, thank you so much. Great story. Ken in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ken.
Hi, I lived in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and I remember coming back to the area, and all the windows were open, all the radios were playing, and you could walk from one block to another and just keep following the news about D-Day. There's something else I'd like to talk about, which is a grand strategy, the grand strategy of World War II, the invasion of Italy, when the Italians admitted defeat like before Americans ever landed, but the war went on. And there was a huge investment in smashing Italy, slowly going up this very narrow territory towards the Apennines and Alps. And only when the Russians were on the way to Berlin did a second invasion happen on over Italy, above the Apennines, and they steamrolled on to Berlin. To get there in time. Stalin understood that this was a way of delaying the war, and that both sides of the war, of the real war, Russia and Germany, should take as much punishment as possible.
Ken, I'm gonna leave it there and get a reaction from Richard Haass. Ken, thank you very much. Richard, what were you thinking during any of that last set of callers?
Well, again, it's I love the story of the wallet, and it just reminds me of a slightly more, I don't know, what's the word, Brian, innocent time of community in our country and common experience. One of the good things about World War II is people from such diverse backgrounds found themselves literally and figuratively in the same boat, in the same landigraft, on the same beach. And I think it was a time in our country when again, there was much more sense of community, of identity as Americans. And at the risk of repeating myself, I worry a little bit that we're losing that thread, that we're so conscious now of our differences of every sort. And this today is a day to kind of look back on what we had, what we have, and what we had in common.
You know, I've seen a few commentators already say this morning that President Trump seems genuinely moved by the ceremonies over there, and maybe this will change his thinking about the Western alliance. I think that must be naive or wishful, but do you think the emotions of today have any resonance beyond looking back with respect?
Look, it's hard to say for him. I thought he gave, in some ways, the finest public statement of his presidency, and I thought there was some memorable language in it. And I think he appeared to be genuinely affected, but I can't tell you on the way home he's not going to take out his phone and start tweeting against Bette Midler or Nancy Pelosi or somebody else. It's just the way things are nowadays. I think in the more cosmic sense you get at it, will this trip affect the way he thinks about our alliances and the importance of American involvement in NATO and in Europe? I doubt it, only because I've spoken with him about this, Brian. He feels so strongly two things. One is that the costs and burdens of American foreign policy over the years have simply not been worth it, that the costs have far outweighed the benefits. And then he looks at allies, by and large, as countries that often take advantage of us, whether it's on the trading front or by not paying as much as he wants on their military spending or what have you. So I doubt that one trip can somehow undo a lifetime of how he thinks about these issues.
How much of a point do you think he might have, even if exaggerated in his Trumpian ways, about the U.S. being taken advantage of by allies? Any?
Not a whole lot, in part because we are a member of an alliance, not as a act of philanthropy for them. We do it in our own self-interest. Tying back to the events of today, we understood that the balance in Europe was essential, not simply for Europeans, but for the entire world, including Americans. But, you know, sure, certain allies should spend more. More important, by the way, than how much they spend is how they spend it. Europeans spend something like $300 billion with a B on defense. The problem is there's too much duplication. There's not enough European integration, so they specialize. But they spend close to half as much on defense as we do. So they're not all free riding. And again, I think he underestimates now the threats that they face and we face, particularly from Russia. What they've done in Ukraine, I don't assume, Brian, that Mr. Putin would not be tempted to do a version of that against some weak NATO state, in part to pull on the thread that is the sweater of that alliance.
And with that concerning statement, we have to leave it with Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much for some time on this of all days.
Thank you, sir.